Good evening, and welcome to What the World Needs Now, with host Ken Johnston. Stay tuned as Ken talks with authors, journalists, and others regarding topics important to us as Catholics in a world that's in desperate need of God's love.
And good afternoon and welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston, and I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners, and thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio, both your financial and prayerful support that's kept us on the air for some 40 years now. And one of the ways you can help us financially is coming up on Sunday, April the 14th. We're going to be out at the Malvern Retreat House for our annual Wake Up America dinner, one of our two annual fundraisers, the second one being our golf outing. Again, Malvern Retreat House, 1:30 to 5:30 on Sunday, April the 14th. We uploaded the flyer with all the information to our website at inhissign.com. If you scroll to the bottom of the homepage, you'll see a link there where you can download the flyer. Also, more information on the events page. If you click on content and then events calendar, you'll see it out there as well. All right. So we got the Wake Up America dinner coming. We mentioned in the 4 o'clock hour the upcoming centenary for Matt Talbot that'll take place in 2025. Planning's underway for events in both Dublin, Ireland, and here locally at our Matt Talbot Shrine in Philadelphia. And as details for that become available, we'll be sure to make you aware. We're hoping to be joined, or I'm hoping to be joined by Jason Jones. In the meantime, maybe we can start with today's gospel. Also, hopefully, I don't know if folks that were listening heard the intro today. On Saturday, March the 9th, it'll be 9 years since Father McKay and I did Saints and Sinners, and I've been hosting this What the World Needs Now on Wednesdays. And just before that that ninth anniversary, we updated the intro to this show. So I want to thank engineer and great help here in Dennis Nolan for making that happen. So let's begin with the gospel from Mass today, which is the Wednesday in the third week of Lent. And it's taken from Matthew chapter 5, so not too far after the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus said to his disciples, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill. Amen, I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or the smallest part of a letter will pass from the law, until all things have taken place. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do so will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever obeys and teaches these commandments will be called greatest in the kingdom of heaven." The Gospel of the Lord. And praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ. And fortunately, on Wednesday mornings, we have a contemplative prayer group down at Our House Ministries. We get together for an hour and read the gospel a couple times and share about it. And then have Mass, where we hear it for a fourth time with an extended period of meditation after communion to think about it. And one of the things that a couple of people, myself included, noticed this morning is, and we read Scripture over and over again, the Sunday readings are in a three-year cycle, the weekday readings in a two-year cycle. And so we would, and during Lent, it's the same readings every day of every year in Lent. So, you know, this is a gospel that I've probably heard, 30, 40, 50 times. And you know, every once in a while, something new will jump out at you. And today it was that the last line, "But whoever obeys and teaches these commandments will be called the greatest in the kingdom." And then the line before that, "Whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do so will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. And it's kind of reassuring that despite that, all the things that I've done in my past, and we were talking about this at the end of the Saints and Sinners show, you know, the mercy of God has made it so that despite all of my sins, the greatest and the least, with God's mercy, I'll be able to experience the kingdom of heaven. You know, elsewhere in the Gospels, you know, it says that it'd be better to have a millstone tied around your neck and tossed in the water than to lead somebody else into sin. And not that I was the Pied Piper in sin and led a whole lot of people to sin, but certainly there were enough people that I ran with that, and I was seldom a leader. I was usually a follower, but I'm sure that there were times where things were my idea, sinful things were my idea, and I dragged others along with me, dragged them down with me, and to know that doesn't permanently exclude me from heaven is a gift of our faith. And you know, because of the world that I lived in for a long time and am still a part of, but on the opposite side, you know, that the life of the addicted and then the life of somebody that's in recovery, that, you know, I got to see a whole lot of things, experience a lot of things, witness things that other people did, other people shared about. And you really see the weaknesses, the fallenness of the human condition. And, you know, when we're born and we're coming up, you know, I wasn't taught by my parents to do a lot of the things that I did. Some of it, maybe, you know, I would, you know, watch my father, you know, drink a beer and drink maybe a lot of beers, and the enjoyment that he seemed to have in doing that. But he never sat me down and told me that, you know, that was a requirement in order to have a happy and joyful life. You know, it was, you know, things that I saw, things that I heard, and then more importantly, the people that I ended up befriending, and that kind of led us down that path. And you know, I see that in this gospel, especially with young people, and the ability that other young people have to knock them off course. I mean, I was a pretty good kid coming up. I went to 12 years of Catholic school. I was on the debate team. I was a straight-A student. And, you know, I would never, ever blame it on the people that I ran with. But they definitely had an influence on me, and not for the better. And, you know, while my parents thought that I had a great life ahead of me, you know, go to college, become a lawyer or whatever I was going to get a degree in, just have a great life. And, you know, it got sidetracked pretty quick, out of college by the time I was 19, and not with a degree, just out because I dropped out. And then the things that I got involved in, I started to work, but, you know, there was a whole lot of play that was involved there. And so, you know, life just circled out of control over a number of years. It would have peaks and valleys. There were, you know, times where, you know, things, at least on the outside, looked pretty good. I managed to get myself in and out of one marriage and then into a second. And, you know, both marriages in the church, and Ullman in between. So I've got, you know, that experience as well. But, you know, able to hide the issues that I had. And it wasn't the alcohol. It was the stuff that was going on inside of me, the turmoil, the wanting to do good and doing bad, just like Paul talks about in the epistles. You know, I do the things I don't want to do and don't do the things that I should. And I was like the poster child for that. And the turmoil that wreaks in your heart, in your soul, especially in your brain, and that, you know, playing the same tapes over and over again, that I'm never going to get ahead, I'm never going to get out of where I am, and that I'm, you know, and I had nobody, in the end, I had nobody to blame but myself for where I had ended up. And yet, somehow or other, in a miraculous moment some 32 years ago, God saw fit for me to begin to find the solution to all my problems. And the solution was Him. It took me a while to completely realize that. I think sometimes God has done some pretty interesting things throughout the course of history, and one of them was found in the 12-step program, and probably more intense back in the 30s when it was founded, but in the way it's given to people today, it's a gentler, softer way, and you know, you don't get hit with the God thing necessarily right away, and unless individuals in a particular meeting that you're going to early on kind of hit you with it. But you know, I saw it in some of the materials and saw it on the signs on the walls, but I didn't realize right away that the solution was God. You know, the solution was hanging out with a new group of people that didn't partake in, you know, what it was that I was addicted to, alcohol. It was reading the literature, doing the steps, and not really putting two and two together early on that all this was going to lead to a relationship with God. And in the end, that's what it is. And the solution is not a solution to drinking. It's a solution to everything that has led us there, or led me there. And I haven't met too many perfect people. I've met quite a few holy people, and I haven't met anybody that's perfect, and everybody has their own stuff going on. And you know, whether it's horrible sins, bad sins, mortal sins, or just the venial ones that again we were talking about in the 4 o'clock hour, that it's in taking a look at them and our actions and what we're doing, and taking that to the next level. You know, why am I doing what I'm doing? Why am I thinking what I'm thinking? And until we do that, we have no chance of changing it. And like I was saying earlier, I'm not going to repeat the whole thing, but you know, it's more recently looking at what are those things that I'm still doing in my humanity, in my human life, that end up taking me to places that I don't want to go. And believe me, they're nowhere like the places I went to 35 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. But just those subtle places where little things can happen. And whether it's getting angry, look at somebody the wrong way, you know, whatever those subtle things are. And today, you know, it was funny. We with Father the other day. I think it was one day last week, maybe. And we were talking, and he was going back and forth with sense of commission and omission, and flipping it around, and what have you. But I got it, and I know today that at least half of the things that I confess in the confessional are the sins of omission, not the sins of commission. And a lot of times I think I don't have time to do this or that. And I know in the back of my head, even in the front of my head, that, you know, what I'm doing right now is not all that important, and that I could be doing something that I think God really needs me to do. And, you know, I'll get to it, God. And next thing you know, enough time passes and it never gets gotten to, or gets gotten to perhaps when it's too late. And this Lenten season, and the church in all its wisdom, you know, a couple times a year provides these seasons like Lent, like Advent, like the Easter season that'll come up following Easter, where we have these extended periods of time to focus on particular areas of our spiritual life. And I think in this Lenten season, you know, we're given that tripod of prayer, fasting, and almsgiving with the intent of growing deeper in our faith. And there's all kinds of ways to do that. We were talking this morning. Patrick mentioned, you know, going to he makes daily mass at St. Richard's a lot and noticing the increased number of people. My home parish of St. Luke's at morning mass during Lent, there's always an increase in the number of people. And a lot of folks will try to make daily mass part of their Lenten practices. And that's great. I mean, anytime we can make daily mass in addition to Sunday mass is a great thing. But I've come to realize that you can benefit from that year round. It doesn't have just have to happen at Lent, and it doesn't not just happen at Advent. That when I make an effort to make daily mass year round, it has a dramatic impact on my relationship with God and on my spiritual life. And so the practices maybe that we're doing in Lent, whatever it is that we're giving up. I had heard somebody talking the other day, and what they've tried to do is whatever they give up for Lent, they give up for life. And the commenter that made that statement had talked about a number of things that he's given up. He gave up for Lent, and he's given it up for life, whether it was candy or coffee or some particular thing that he had used as part of his penitential Lent. You know, just made it a lifelong commitment. And I'm certainly not calling on anybody to do that, but to at least think about it, that, you know, these habits that we try to formulate over the course of 40 days and of Lent, and I know it's a few more than that actual number, but whatever practices that we pick up and start to work on in those 40 days, you know, when Easter comes, it's not a time to just give it up. You know, maybe this year, if you haven't done it in the past, consider continuing with that. And it's been a boon in my spiritual life to continue to do some of those things. But I wouldn't do it if there wasn't a goal at the end. And where this came from, again, was building that relationship with God. Because we can find happiness in life without God. Lord knows there's, of the 8 billion people, maybe there's 4 billion that have found a way to do that. And they'll get glimpses of happiness. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep doing what they're doing or chasing what they're chasing, because at some point it gave them some joy, it gave them some happiness, but it was fleeting. And so they try to chase that. That's the MO of the addict. You know, that the first time that we got tipsy, the first time that we get high, that we have that euphoric feeling, and we realize that it was something that we had done that brought about that feeling. We chase it for, and some people will chase it till they die. They'll die, literally die, chasing that euphoric feeling that they had once, whether it was a year ago, 10 years ago, or 20 or 30 years ago. And so you can get those fleeting moments without God, but it's only with God that we get that permanent joy. And, you know, for many of us, that permanent joy probably won't come until we're in the kingdom. The kingdom being heaven. We can be in the kingdom here on earth today if we care to. All we have to do is ask God for the gift and try to lead holy lives, and we can be in the kingdom today. You know, Jesus Christ said the kingdom of God is at hand, and he's not a liar. If it wasn't at hand, he wouldn't have said it. So at hand means at hand. Here's my hands. It's right here. It's mine for the taking. But there's, you know, prescriptions on how to live there and how to get there. And Jesus lays them all out in the Gospels. And, you know, sometimes it just takes some of us like me with the thick head that you have or that I have to get through, you know, what it is that we really need to do in order to experience the kingdom here on earth. And I think God allows us to get little glimpses of it here and there. The further we grow in the spiritual life, we may get longer glimpses. For those, you know, that listen on the last Wednesdays of the month, and we talked about the gift of the divine will, And living in the divine will, you can experience extended periods of that joy. And that's even despite the pain and suffering, the trials, the tribulations that God sends our way. It's when we experience joy in the middle of them that we realize that it's not of us, that it's not of others around us, that it's only of God. And to even mention that or talk about it, to be able to experience any kind of joy in the midst of suffering, you know, some people will think you're nuts, you know, that we need to do everything in our power to avoid suffering. And many of us do that, and maybe we can avoid it for some period of time, but sooner or later, it's going to come. We have one friend who's extreme pain day in and day out, physical pain, as a result of some conditions that he has, especially with his back. And even in the midst of that pain, every once in a while, you know, they'll talk about the joy that he has experienced. And a guest that we have next week, and again, I apologize. We were supposed to have Jason Jones on today. I followed up with the publisher this week and thought for certain he would be here. Hopefully we'll be able to reschedule him, especially since the book doesn't come out until next month. But the guest that we'll have next week, and we'll make sure that we have him, Father Mahar, M-A-H-A-R, so I think it's pronounced Mahar, you know, wrote a book on suffering. And it's only because of God, it's only because of Jesus Christ that suffering has meaning. And I know that that's not the first time that that I've said that. And, you know, I've been blessed in my own life, despite some of the crazy things I did that could have brought a whole lot more suffering than what I've actually experienced. That, and that the suffering that I've experienced of late, you know, there's a purpose to it. And I don't know exactly why God allows it to happen. I don't know why he piles some of the suffering on certain people that he does. Perhaps, you know, we'll get the answer in this lifetime and somehow or other come to realize why that is. I know we'll find out when we get to heaven. The other thing that I do know is that, you know, when we were taught as kids to offer it up, you know, the people that were teaching us that were serious. And while it sounds childlike, you know, offer it up, and the people that I've met that have truly offered it up, that have taken the suffering and made it meaningful, whether they offered it for their families, for loved ones, for friends, for the church, for anything and everything that they've offered it for, that's where it gains meaning. And a preview for this article I mentioned that I'm working on, you know, it's in reading about the passion on a daily basis now, something that's become part of my spiritual life. It's in reading the passion and, you know, what Jesus really went through. And there's a number of sources for that. You recall the movie The Passion that Mel Gibson did. And a lot of that was based on the mysticism of Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich and the books that she wrote, The Passion of the Christ. The source I'm using right now is from Louisa Picaretta in The Hours of the Passion, a book that does have an imprimatur and a Neil Obstadt, from one of her confessors, who was a canonized saint, St. Honorable de Francia, whose statue is actually on top of the buildings there in St. Peter's Square. If you've ever seen the pictures, whether it's during the election of a pope or whatever's going on in St. Peter's Square, if they show you the outline of the top of the buildings, you'll see a number of saints whose statues are up there. And in the future, if you look, if they start panning from the left, the second statue is St. Honorable de Francia. And St. Honorable was Louise's, one of Louise's confessors. And so this book, The Hours of the Passion, that is a compilation of the messages that Jesus gave to Louisa about his passion. The detail that's in there and the suffering that Jesus experienced during that passion is just incredible. And I've shared with a couple of folks lately that in reading what went on long before he gets to the cross, you know, it starts, you know, before he even gets to the Last Supper. You know, in that first hour, and Louisa has a Picaretta has it broken down into the 24 hours. You know, that first hour is when he's preparing to leave his mother, and to head to the cenacle, to head to the upper room where he's going to have the Last Supper with his apostles, and the emotions that were going on in those moments when Jesus was going to leave his mother. You know, and according to some, you know, in Scripture, in the Gospels, when we hear about the prophecy of Simeon, it's a few lines in the Gospel. In other places, not recorded in the Bible, you know, there was a whole lot more to the prophecy from Simeon to Mary, and so she had a pretty good idea, I think, of what was about to happen. So in that last hour that she and her son Jesus Christ have together, and knowing that things that were going to go down over the next 24 hours were going to be just horrific. And while Jesus Christ would suffer a lot of that physically, in reading what he told Louisa, he experienced as much emotionally, if not more emotionally, than he did physically. And certainly the Blessed Mother would experience all of that emotionally to the point where, you know, I think if God hadn't given her the grace to go through it, you know, anybody would have been, you know, would have fallen under the pressure. And she didn't, to the point where, you know, in those final moments, you know, there were only a few people left at the foot of the cross, being, of course, Mary Magdalene, the Blessed Mother, and St. John the Apostle. So we've reached the bottom of the hour, and we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, if we're not joined by the guest, and I don't think we will be, we'll continue with talking about the Hours of the Passion. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
My name is Mario D'Adamo, and I have been a faithful listener to Inner Sign Radio Ministry since 1990, and to Kathleen McCarthy as principal host since 2007. Hearing the witness of Kathleen and her guests has contributed greatly to my spiritual growth. They have educated me about the tenets of my Catholic faith by presenting lay and religious leaders discuss topics that help listeners create an informed Catholic conscience. I always encourage people who are in need of prayer and companionship to listen, call in, and become part of our radio listener family by joining thousands of other people praying for your intentions. I personally can attest to the power of the prayers from the ministry. Kathleen often reminds her listeners that you are never alone because the Lord is always with us. Through this Catholic radio and internet apostolate, the Lord is indeed with us in a very tangible way. Please share the good news as Kathleen takes a leap of faith and expanding to a two-hour program to reach many more people who need to experience the love of God. Thank you.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We are blessed to have had this Catholic radio apostolate for almost 40 years now. Thanks be to God for your partnership. Without you, this radio voice would be silenced. We have a monthly Mass offered for you, our loyal family of listeners. It's our way of saying thank you for underpinning our apostolate with your many prayers and financial support. This is your radio ministry, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to evangelize and to catechize for a time such as this. We know the Lord will bless you abundantly. He can never be outdone in generosity. If this ministry has touched your heart, help us to touch other hearts by supporting us with your prayers and financial support. Call us at 610-527-2906 or visit our website at inhissign.com.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston. Again, I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners, and thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio, both your financial and prayerful support that has kept us on the air for some 40 years now. And just blessed to be a part of this great radio apostolate. And you can help us out. Coming up on Sunday, April the 14th, will be our annual Wake Up America dinner. We'll be at the Malvern Retreat House from 1:30 to 5:30. Kathleen McCarthy will be on hand, as usual, and the keynote speaker. We also have a special guest this year in her son-in-law, or as Kathleen says, her son-in-love, Mark Houck, will also be on hand to give a talk to us. So hopefully you can join us. You can get all the information at our website, inhissign.com. Scroll to the bottom of the homepage, and you'll find a link there to download the flyer. There's also sponsorship opportunities in addition to reserving a table or individual tickets. So we hope to see you there on April the 14th. We're going to go to the phones, and we got Mario on the line. Hello, Mario.
How are you?
Brother, how are you?
All right.
Otter God, when you know we play these spots during the break, and yours came up as Patrick was writing your name on the board here. So,
Oh wow, that is an Otter God.
Yeah.
Question: maybe I misunderstood something you said. Louisa Picaretta, you said her confessor statue was up in St. Peter's.
Correct. Right?
Well, she died in 1947. How was the statue of the confessor?
He wasn't. He was canonized by John Paul II. So he was her confessor early on. I don't know the exact years, Mario, but he was the second or third of a string of confessors that she had. He was probably the most important and for the longest. But when he was canonized, I think it was in the 90s, was when his statue was placed up on top of St. Peter's.
I got you. And the other question was, Louisa Picaretta, her writings are sanctioned by the church, or are they left up to each individual to determine whether or not they're worthy of belief? I'm just not sure.
Yeah, so there's of late there's been some controversy about the writings. And in talking to Father Iannuzzi, who's a theologian and has done a lot of work in that area, and others that I follow. So the first, she wrote a total of 36 volumes. It's like 10,000 pages. And of those 36, 19 volumes have a Neo-Obstat and an Imprimatur. And that's it, but that's in the Italian language that obviously she wrote in.
Right.
What has happened over the years is there's nothing in the volumes that, you know, goes against church teaching, is heretical or anything along those lines. There's I compare it to the Diary of Faustina, where there were issues in the translations, and the kibosh was put on the diary for a number of years. There's minor issues with some of the translation that went on with Louisa's writings. So what we're waiting for and hoping for is that the Vatican-approved translations will be available sometime in the near future. So it's again, and this isn't something that's required for salvation, right? It's private revelation, right, just like Margaret Mary Alacoque and the Sacred Heart and the Miraculous Medal and Catherine Labouré, Louis de Montfort. That was all private revelation. So it's not a requirement, but to my understanding, and again, I'm involved in with some people. We read the volumes every morning. Is that there's nothing wrong with individuals that want to take a look at this, and you're not going to find anything in there that goes against church teaching.
Good enough. All right, Ken, thank you very much for clearing that up for me. Yeah. I appreciate it. You take care.
All right, you too, brother. Always good to hear from you. God bless you,
Ken. Take care.
You too.
Right,
bye-bye. Yeah, and yeah, to Mario's point, and we had Mother Gabriel and Peter De Palma on last week, and they've addressed it too. Daniel O'Connor spent a lot of time in his podcast. I've had Daniel on the radio a few times. The last handful of talks he's given on YouTube are addressing the various issues that have been raised, and they're nothing new. And you know, when you think about politics and you watch the people that are being attacked, it's usually because they're, you know, what do they say, they're over the target. And the gift of the divine will that's been gaining more and more momentum is over the target. And as a result, whether we talk about the gift of the divine will, other writers that have talked and other seers that have talked about the chastisements and the warning and the thousand-year reign of peace on earth. Again, it's not something that you have to believe, that you have to dive into yourself. I mean, divine mercy, and you know, we've got a saint in Saint Faustina. We've got her diary. We've got a day in the church that Jesus requested in Divine Mercy Sunday. And yet how many parishes, you know, don't really celebrate Divine Mercy Sunday and follow the prescription that Jesus requested. And I understand. I've had a number of people that have contacted me, and usually it's every year, either right before or right after Divine Mercy Sunday. And they'll say to me, you know, why are some parishes or some churches, they don't seem to address Divine Mercy Sunday? And I'd love for, a priest or a pastor to call in and explain it. But my take is that, you know, this is in the history of the church, it's something that is like brand new, even though for us it's, 23, 24, 25 years old. In the canonization of Faustina, and really the adding the John Paul II, adding Divine Mercy Sunday to the church calendar, that it wasn't there when a lot of our priests were being formed. It wasn't part of their formation in seminary. And to dive deep into Faustina's diary and to try to understand the depths of it, it's not something that's going to happen overnight. I mean, we have the whole order of priests, the Marians of the Immaculate Conception up in Stockbridge, whose lives are dedicated to Faustina's message. And, you know, there's always plenty of stuff on YouTube and on the Marians website to learn more about the Divine Mercy. But frankly, I think our priests have their hands full today. That there's not too many of them that are not pastors, Not too many parishes that have a second priest. Certainly they have the help of deacons, but the workload that our priests have now, and the workload that's going to be laid on them in the next couple of years, especially with, you know, all our priests when the seminary was full in the 60s and 70s, you know, a lot of those men are going to be retiring in the next couple of years. And so, you know, the ones that are left to run our parishes are going to be burdened. I think it's going to be time for our laity to step it up and to unburden the priests as best we can. I think we need to pray, you know, not only for vocations and more priests, but to pray for those that are already ordained and that they'll be able to accept the grace that God's going to give them in order to, you know, do whatever it is that God needs them to do in those coming years. Because I don't think it's going to be easy. Now, the flip side of that is the chastisement and the warning could all come next week. And we know after that that our churches will be full again. Probably our seminaries will be full. They'll probably be wishing that they hadn't decided to sell St. Charles maybe. But the bottom line is that God is going to provide. And that in doing so, He'll hopefully provide the priests that we need. The seers that are out there have talked about, you know, periods where the sacraments might be available. Some of the talks recently from Father Chad Ripperger, who's becoming really popular lately, you know, he just did a talk on what to do when the sacraments are not available. And, you know, it's not like we can't say that'll never happen, because, you know, we only need to look back 3 years ago and to see what the world and certain elitists, certain world leaders in this world were able to do to the church. They shut us down. Thank God, you know, there were some rogue priests, if you will, that were out there. They were having drive-through confessions where you could maybe drive through at the parking lot. He'd be in his car and you'd be in your car. I've heard stories of that, that there were some that may have offered communion, may have offered even mass in certain situations. But, you know, to say that that we'll always have the sacraments is not a guarantee. And so at the beginning of the show and talking about the gospel and, you know, maybe some of the things that we're doing for Lent, you know, now's the time to make daily mass, because it's not always guaranteed. And kind of disappointed that we didn't have Jason Jones on, because his book is about how to, you know, the campaign against the Great Reset. And that's, you know, the whole experience with COVID and other things that seem to be going on, all, you know, starting 50, 60 years ago, has all pointed to, you know, driving us away from Christ. And I think fortunately, it's backfiring in a number of areas. And not only is it not driving people away from God, it's drawing them closer. Because the more confusion, the harder life gets, the more pain and suffering that people experience, you know, that there's only a couple of ways to deal with that. You know, the ultimate bad way to deal with it, obviously, is to take your own life, to get out of the suffering altogether, or think you're getting out of the suffering altogether by taking your own life. You know, other ways are to, you know, self-medicate and do whatever you think you need to do in order to avoid that suffering. But it's going to come. And again, it's only with and through God that suffering has an explanation and meaning. And we'll be talking a whole lot about that next week. To get back to where we were when we went to the break in talking about Christ's passion. And like I said, it's not just in Louisa's writings. It's also in Anne Catherick Emmerich's writings and a number of other mystics, you know, over the centuries, you know, of what Christ actually went through. And sometimes, you know, I really wish it wasn't just seemingly glossed over in Scripture. Now, part of that might have been because, you know, some of the gospel writers, certainly John the Apostle was there, but, you know, the others weren't there to experience it firsthand, and maybe they didn't think that, you know, what went on leading up to the Passion itself was, or leading up to the crucifixion, wasn't as important as the crucifixion itself. And I can see that. We were talking in the 4 o'clock hour that Jesus' goal from the moment he was conceived in Mary's womb was the crucifix. He spent 30 years in private life communing with his father, I'm certain, learning from Joseph and the Blessed Mother, and you know, putting together the plan that was going to be executed when he did go public. And, you know, in those 3 short years, the messages that he had to get to people and to make sure that those messages were preserved for centuries. I think sometimes the early Christians, the way they talked and the things that they did, they thought that Christ's coming was imminent within months or years. Certainly, I don't think those apostles thought that it was going to be, you know, take 2,000 years for Christ to return. And for whatever reason, it has. And so maybe when they were writing the Gospels, they didn't feel a need to talk about the details. Where I'm going with all this is that as I meditate on the Passion during this Lent and read of everything that Christ experienced from that moment that he kissed his mother goodbye to head to the upper room until he was laid in that tomb, there was so many horrific things that took place. My good friend, fellow high school graduate, Father John Wackerman, he purchased a crucifix, and it may have been a year ago, and it's Jesus on the cross, and there's not a square inch of his body that's not marred from either whips, rods, or chains that took place in the scourging. And, you know, when I go into churches today or, you know, look at the crucifixes that are around, and sometimes you'll see a little trickle of blood on the where the nails were driven in his hands and feet, and you'll see a little trickle of blood on his chest where his heart was pierced, where his chest was pierced with the lance. I think he was far bloodier than that. And I think in a Protestant churches, the few that I've been in, they don't even put the corpus on the cross. It's removed because the focus is more on the resurrection than it is on the sacrifice. Our Mass is all about the sacrifice. There's a great video that's out there that was shared with me again by Father Wackerman, and I forget the priest's name. And again, it gives me an opportunity to plug my Substack, notsaintyet.substack.net. The Thursday post recently, I've put a link to the video at the bottom, and it talks about the sacrifices from the Old Testament, beginning with Cain and Abel, all the way up to the crucifixion, and how all that is experienced at the Mass. And we've kind of whitewashed it and cleaned it up. And a lot of times that's not the focus. It's certainly not mine. I can't speak for everybody. I know there was a period there, especially when the movie, The Passion, was made, where people, you know, that went to see that movie realized how horrific the events were leading up to the crucifixion. And, In reading about the scourging, and I know our friend Patrick here at the parish of St. Barnabas, they have a statue of Jesus there, actually he's lying down, and the body marred. The first time I saw that in person, it's just gruesome. And when you read about it, and that they would first whip Jesus with ropes, and then they would have rods spikes on the end of it that they hit them with repeatedly. And, you know, it wasn't the same people that would do all these scourgings. They would actually get tired and switch off. It was like a tag team wrestling match. You know, the two get tired, they would tag the next two and hit them with the rods with the spikes or nails on it. And then finally with the chains with the hooks on it. And despite all that, Jesus had his eye on the goal. He was going to save us no matter what. No matter what. He wasn't going to let Herod stop him. He wasn't going to let Pontius Pilate stop him. He wasn't going to let the apostles stop him. I think one of the reasons perhaps that St. Joseph wasn't around when Jesus went through this is Joseph probably would have tried to stop it like any father would. If somebody wanted to do it to my son what they did to Jesus, I would try to get in the middle of it and stop it. But Jesus had that laser focus, and he was going to the cross no matter what. Nothing was going to stop him from getting there. And brothers and sisters, that's why in the last couple of weeks, the last month or so, it's all come to a head in my own head about the suffering that he was willing to do. And, you know, I've heard it said that, you know, if I was the only person, the only human being ever created, that Jesus would have done it just for me. And I believe that. That's how much Jesus loves me. But the fact that he's willing to do it despite the billions and trillions and quadrillion times that he's been offended, not just in the last 2,000 years since the crucifixion, but the 4,000 years before that, that he was willing to take all that on so that we can experience heaven. You have to be grateful. I can't look at the crucifix the same way again after realizing that. And yet we live in a world today where that's the last thing that anybody wants to, the people that control the media, people that are, you know, control our governments or politics, they don't want to talk about it. You know, you go back 50, 60 years, and it was one of the school districts right here in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. You know, the Abington School District, I believe, is where it started with taking prayer out of school. They've been at it now for 60, 70 years, and I don't know how much longer we're going to be able to continue the way we are. And I'm not a seer. I'm not a prognosticator. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen an hour from now, let alone tomorrow, next week, next month. I do suspect that God, for our sake, not because he's vengeful or has it out for us, but for our own sake, I think that sooner rather than later, God's going to step in. There's been messages floating around even as late as last week. You know, with messages from God the Father that the time is coming sooner rather than later. And again, we don't have to believe any of it. And if we prepare for that moment, even if it doesn't happen next week or next month or next year or 10 years from now, even if it doesn't happen in our lifetime, when we meet God face to face, and every one of us is going to do that sooner or later, when we meet him face to face, we'll be prepared. What comes to mind is the meditation on the last four things: heaven and hell, death and judgment. And you know, Lent lays it right out there for us. You know that the readings that we have, even the gospel that we have from today, you know, there's judgment involved. Therefore, whoever leads one of the least of these, whoever breaks one of these least commandments and teaches others to do so will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever obeys and teaches these commandments will be called greater in the kingdom of heaven. Who's going to decide who's least and who's greater? Christ. God, the ultimate judge. And if we dwell on it, and not dwell on it in a negative way, but meditate and contemplate that idea, heaven and hell, death and judgment, it's going to change our lives. It changed my life. I have no desire whatsoever to go to hell. I don't think I ever did. I thought at one point that that's surely where I was going to end up because of the things that I've done. And only through God's grace and mercy was I able to change my ways and receive God's mercy in sacramental confession to know that for a fact that my sins have been absolved and that the ones that have been confessed are not the ones that are going to keep me out of the kingdom. One of the things I've been doing of late, for better or worse, is asking Our Lady of Sorrows to reveal to me any unconfessed sins because I want to get it cleaned up. And I have the opportunity to do that now. I don't want to have to wait until my deathbed or wait until I'm in purgatory to experience the absolution for those. I had a guest on almost a year ago around the same time as Father Lundgren and Father Tom Morrow, classmate of Father McKay's, but he was for the diocese of either Washington, D.C. or Baltimore, I forget which, you know, in his book Straight to Heaven. You know, purgatory is optional. It's not a must. You know, if we can figure out a way to detach ourselves while we're here on this earth to ask for and accept God's grace to be rid of all those things that would prevent us from going directly to heaven, we might just be able to do it and avoid purgatory altogether. Whatever you do, do not shoot for purgatory. Because like Mother Gabriel said last week, you shoot for purgatory and you miss. It's not going to be a pleasant thing, but shoot for heaven. And when we miss, we may experience the gift of purgatory. So once again, I want to thank you all for being with me for whatever part of the 2 hours on this Wednesday. And I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday, Father McKay in the 4 o'clock hour, Father Moore in the 5 o'clock hour talking about suffering. But until then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Take care, and God bless.